This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Women's Hour podcast for Wednesday, the 29th of July. Good morning. In today's programme, black women in the music industry. While some, like Beyoncé, Rihanna, Aretha Franklin, Tina Turner or Whitney Houston became international superstars, how do the talented but maybe less powerful fare in their careers? And the serial episode 3 of Babelsberg Babylon. I'll get there in the end. Now, I suspect most of us at some time in our lives have suffered from premenstrual tension or maybe period pain. But there is a less common extreme form of PMS called premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, which has driven some of the women who suffer from it to distraction. The BBC has carried out research into the condition, which is thought to affect around 1 million women in the UK. The researchers heard from 4,000 women, of whom nearly 3,000 said they'd had suicidal thoughts as a result of the pain they suffered. 1,500 said they harmed themselves in the days before their period. Some of them told us what they had gone through.
I suffered from brain fog, suicidal ideations, stuttering. I would suffer immensely, mentally, physically, emotionally. And month upon month, it was actually getting worse.
For as long as I can remember, I have lived with depression and anxiety, amongst other symptoms, exhaustion, lethargy, some flu-like symptoms, headaches. Sometimes I would feel really myself, getting on with life, enjoying life, and then suddenly I'd switch really, really quickly and drop into a deep, deep depression. I didn't know why, I didn't know what was wrong with me, I thought it was my personality. It was terrifying.
I just can't cope being suicidal. So yeah, this is something that PMDD can do, and generally this is for 1 to 2 weeks of every single month. Every single month of my life.
He basically told me it's just PMS and we don't know what causes PMS, so there's nothing I can really do. But eat more soy and take evening primrose oil. And I was just sitting there thinking, I was crying at the time as well, and I just thought, I've just told you that I was suicidal, and this is what you're telling me to do, eat more soy.
I've been given a lot of leaflets about PMS and having a bath and smelling some lavender, having some chocolate, cuddling a dog, I mean, standard.
I had to repeat myself 17 times to the crisis team explaining what my condition was. Now, someone who's just attempted to take their life had to explain 17 times what the condition is. Now, that is completely unacceptable.
I was put up on pretty high doses of antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds. I was on reduced hours at work, and nothing would get on top of the lows. Nobody had ever, ever mentioned to me about tracking my menstrual cycle against my mental health symptoms. I never thought to look to see if there was a pattern. I didn't know it was a thing, so why would I have thought to do that? Now I look back, it seems so obvious.
I had a full hysterectomy with both ovaries removed. I had to fight to have this operation because a girl at 38 years old, why would she want to have this operation and put herself in additional risks?
As a very, very last resort, after going through the treatment pathway, I had a full hysterectomy and bilateral oophorectomy. So that's uterus, tubes, ovaries, everything out to make sure I no longer had cycles. At the age of 33, but now I have my life back, my kids have their mum back, and the future is looking bright.
Well, PMDD has only recently been recognised as a condition by the World Health Organization. What progress has been made in understanding it and treating it? Well, Laura Murphy is the Director of Education and Awareness for the International Association for Premenstrual Disorders and the founder of Vicious Cycle, making PMDD visible. Dr. Paula Briggs is a consultant in sexual and reproductive health at Liverpool Women's NHS Trust. Paula, how would you describe PMDD?
PMDD is a cyclical problem. It's related to ovulation. The symptoms are completely relieved by menstruation. So obviously all women, if they're not using contraception, will have a menstrual cycle, but not all women suffer from PMDD. And it would appear that some women have a sort of abnormal brain sensitivity to their own cyclical hormones.
We heard from women there who said they had had suicidal thoughts. How common is that?
Well, you know, I think it's difficult to be sure just how common this is. I think the World Health Organization's adding the condition to their classification of diseases gives PMDD a legitimate diagnosis, and we may well see now, with raising awareness, more women coming forward to express severe symptoms, including suicidal thoughts. So, you know, at the moment, we think it's the severe end of the spectrum, and I think that's right, but I just think the absolute numbers are not clear.
Laura, what did you make of the voices we heard just now, the women talking about what they had gone through?
Very emotional. Actually, I know a lot of those people that were speaking, and it's very hard hearing their explanations. I suffered for 17 years myself, undiagnosed, and I can relate to so much of what they were saying. I speak to people daily who are going through this. It doesn't surprise me that they're having to explain themselves to crisis teams. We see that a lot, people in crisis going through the mental health system and people not knowing what it is. In some cases, doctors withdrawing hormonal treatment that would normally be helping them. But it doesn't surprise me, sadly.
What do you mean by the hormonal treatment that may be helpful?
So in terms of treatment of PMDD, you want to flatten out the fluctuations. Like Dr. Briggs said, it's a response to the fluctuations, a negative response in the brain to the hormonal fluctuations. So cycle suppression is often used as a treatment option to flatten down those fluctuations that occur every month.
What was your actual experience of it? What was it like for you?
Very traumatic. So started at around 17 when I took the contraceptive pill, and on day 21, obviously you go to the sugar pills, and the massive drop just triggered something in me. Life was never really the same again. I suffered from mental health problems for many years. I know I suffered from severe PMS, but never quite linked the two. I would just fall into a pit of depression every month. Panic attacks, anxiety. It ramped up in my 30s to the point where I was losing half a month. I would forget how to drive. I would forget how to speak. It would be like wading through treacle. And to be honest, it was like going through a bereavement every month.
What extent, Laura, do you think it was connected with starting to take the contraceptive pill?
In my case, it was definitely triggered by the pill on that day 21. I was literally floored. My life just changed forever. My personality changed forever. I went into a deep depression and things were never the same again, sadly.
Paula, why might that be the case, that the contraceptive pill would have that impact?
I think what Laura's describing is the impairment associated with sensitivity to hormones that women with PMDD have. When we prescribe the pill as a means of treating this condition, we would normally use a very specific combination, trying to minimise any adverse effects. And also now I think most experts in the field would recommend that women take the pill continuously and they don't have a break. And by doing that, we inhibit ovulation, but we provide the woman with stable hormones, so she loses that fluctuation that's causing her the issues.
Laura, why do you think it took such a long time, 17 years, to be given a diagnosis?
That's a good question. Lack of awareness, lack of training at GP level in women's health generally. PMDD is not included in any training. I remember going to my doctor and saying something is seriously wrong. I think I have bipolar, you know, and I was saying my PMS is really bad. I mean, really, it was so obvious. She even got her book out and said, you know, I don't think it's bipolar. But I was never asked to track my mood symptoms alongside my cycle. So just daily, I was kind of bumbling along, up and down, having good patches, having bad patches, but never really making the connection to my menstrual cycle.
Paula, I know you used to be a GP, so you must have seen a lot of this in general practice. What difference will the recent recognition of it as a condition by the World Health Organization make to maybe doctors getting better trained in it?
Well, previously we were using an American definition or categorization. So the WHO will make this a global diagnosis, and that should be supported by a shared language and training. And I've said before, I think it's very hard for GPs. They can't possibly know everything about everything. But I think just raising awareness, I think the BBC coverage has been exceptional, just showing how severely affected women can be. And I think Laura makes a really important part about how crucial the diagnosis is. And so if more people, more GPs or primary care clinicians were aware of the need for women to track their symptoms over 2 months, that would make a big difference. And there are some really good things available to help with that. Apps are available, so patients or affected women could start recording their symptoms even before they go to their GP, and it just helps make the diagnosis much more robust.
I know, Paula, that Laura had surgery, like some of the women we heard earlier, but you were involved in a recent trial. What happened as a result of that trial?
There were great hopes that the drug that we were trialling, which was called isoallopregnanolone, and that would block the effect of allopregnanolone, which is a metabolite of progesterone, and that's what we think causes PMDD. But unfortunately, there was a very high placebo response to that drug, and that's been well recognised in this condition, that there is a high placebo response to treatments, and the reasons for that will be extremely complicated. I think some of the placebo response related to the fact that the women were given credibility for their condition. Our research nurse was exceptional and spent a huge amount of time being available for the women. And I think that made a big difference. So, you know, if nothing more came of the current publicity around PMDD, I think just listening to women and taking them seriously would be a huge step forward.
Dr. Paula Briggs and Laura Murphy, thank you both very much indeed for being with us this morning. We would, of course, like to hear from you. If you've experienced this, you can send us an email, or, of course, you can tweet us, and you don't have to give your name if you don't want to. And if you're feeling distressed at the moment and you'd like details of organisations that might offer advice and support, just go online to bbc.co.uk/actionline. Or you can call for free at any time to hear recorded information. The number there is 0800 066 066. And there are, of course, links to help you on the Woman's Hour website. Now, still to come in today's programme, the third episode of The Serial, Babelsberg Babylon. Earlier in the week, you may have missed a discussion about sex robots, and yesterday, Jackie Clune on her new novel, and a discussion about women and cycling. If you missed the live programme, you know you can always find us on BBC Sounds. And as part of a summer series on how to do a number of things, last week Jane led a discussion about friendship, how to be a good friend, with Sally Hughes, Jenny Eclair and Radhika Sangani, who's recently made new friends even in lockdown.
Most of my friends were from school and university, and I kind of realised that we'd all really grown apart. A lot of people were starting to get married and have kids, and I was living a very different lifestyle, and I started to feel a little bit lonely. So I decided to set out and make new friends, which always feels really weird as an adult because it just seems like something you do as a child or at university. So I found it a little bit daunting, but I kind of really set about trying to make new friends. Whether it was staying later in my yoga class to speak to the teacher or starting to speak to neighbours or, you know, like with colleagues actually saying, let's go for a drink rather than just kind of, you know, having lunch together and that's it. So that sort of was like step one. And it made me realise that it is possible to make new friends as an adult. Mm. And then when lockdown happened, I'm living alone. And I felt quite lonely again at the beginning. And again, lots of my friends were in lockdown with partners or families. So I was like, something needs to change. I can't just be lonely for however long this is going to be. So I sort of just started putting into practice all the skills I learned with step one of making friends. And I basically just befriended loads of my neighbours. And now we have Friday drinks every Friday in the garden. Mm. I've befriended people who live in cafes near me. I've started outdoor yoga classes. And it's kind of become this lovely community.
Do you think, Sally, that there's ever a time when you simply decide to stop making new friends?
I hear this quite a lot, people saying, well, I've got enough friends, the books are closed, I'm done now. And I understand that impulse if you do have really great friends. But I do think it's not a particularly kind of good way to think about the world. My books are always open. If I meet somebody and I'm kind of enchanted or intrigued, then I pursue it, because I kind of feel like when you're sick of meeting other people, you're sick of life in a way. There have been occasions, maybe once every couple of years, where I meet someone really special and I make room.
And Jenny Eclair, are you still able to make room for new mates?
I have been in my past a bit of a lousy friend, and now that I've hit 60, I'm looking back and I think that I'm very lucky to have some very loyal mates who stuck with me through years of me sort of not really paying them enough attention. I'm slightly suspicious of making new friends. This sounds like a bit me, but I think when I was very busy gigging, and I was suspicious of why people wanted to be friends with me. I thought if they expected the same persona that I was on stage, and they were going to be entertained, they were going to get all this free entertainment, they were going to get very disappointed.
Jenny Eclair, Sally Hughes and Radhika Sangani. And starting next week, we're going to be talking to women about scars. How do you deal with physical and probably emotional pain and deal with other people's reactions on a day-to-day basis? Well, Jane had a flesh-eating bug. Emily has overcome self-harm. Amy lives with psoriasis. And Laura is a burn survivor.
From my belly button down to my toes, I've always said that my scars look like scrumpled up tights. They feel smooth and normal, but not normal to look at. They've got lumps and bumps, but it looks like you're wearing a corset.
And you can hear more about scars next week. And the Black Lives Matter movement has brought attention to a number of areas of society where discrimination and prejudice rumble beneath the surface. There are a number of black women in the music industry who've risen to become international superstars. Beyoncé is perhaps the best example. But what of the others who have talent but haven't reached the pinnacle of power in popular music? Olivia Cope has spoken to Jacqueline Springer, who's a journalist and teaches music. Lioness MC is a grime rapper who's been performing for more than 10 years. Fleur East is an artist who writes songs. She came second in the X Factor in 2014. How has her colour influenced her progress?
Well, one of the first things that comes to mind is that it's kind of like the unspoken dialogue that you have whenever you see any other like black artist. You don't even need to open your mouth. It's like you just look at each other and you go, hmm. Like you kind of know, it's an unspoken experience, but it's shared and everyone kind of knows what's going on. But I remember the first time it became an issue. I think, I can't remember who it was that said it to me, but I think I just came out of a record label meeting or something. And someone there who was working there that was a black person came up to me and said, so how's it going? Like, how are you finding it all? And I was like, yeah, really exciting. Like, you know, I'm loving it. And then they went, no, but how's it going? And they just like pointed at their hand, like as if to gesture at the skin, at their skin tone. They were like, no, how's it really? And I was like, oh, wow. I was like, okay. And then there's the comments you get like, oh, you're so talented, man. Honestly, this country's mad. If you were white, you'd be 10 times more successful. Like, people are sleeping on you. And hearing things like that, that's so frustrating to hear that, because you kind of know there's an element of truth to it, but at the same time, it's something that you can't prove or even something you can't really explain. It's something you can't dictate. So the minute you even bring that up, it's like, oh, you're pulling out the race card, whatever, that's nonsense. And to be fair, there's so many other elements that contribute to your success besides race. So there's like being a female in the industry, there's timing, there's the platform you launched into the industry, like via. So there's so many elements, but at the same time, there's definitely an issue when it comes to opportunities and marketing and things like that when it comes to race in the music industry, for sure.
And when you get those comments that come from other black people in the music industry, you know, this person was like, how's it really going? Is it very, it's very hush hush, like it's nothing they would say in front of the executives or, you know, the management or whoever. It's very behind closed doors conversations.
Yeah, very behind closed doors. No one would have an open conversation about that. But that's what I've kind of found fascinating since the Black Lives Matter conversations opened up, because you're seeing everybody just speaking up about this stuff, like Misha B's account, Alexandra Burke, Leona Lewis, Leanne from Little Mix, like they're all going on their socials, openly sharing all their experiences. Now for me, and I'm sure for many other black artists in the industry, you know, this isn't news to us. This isn't a surprise. It's not shocking. You know, it's not groundbreaking. We've all experienced similar things. So for us, it's just like, okay, wow, we're in that time. We can talk about this now. This is cool now. Okay. So we're feeling empowered to share those stories. But for many people who haven't been aware of it, to them, this is a real surprise. It's almost like, where's this coming from? Is everyone just now jumping on this trend? Are people now just trying to get fame by claiming that they face racism? Which is like the most frustrating thing, to be fair, that I've heard. That really annoys me. It's just like, people aren't making these things up. This is a daily struggle. These are experiences that people have been through throughout their whole lives. But it's just now that we feel the floor is open, we're feeling more confident to share these stories. And I think it's really important that people do, because the minute you hear one story, you go, okay, I'm not alone in this. This is a thing. It's real.
Mm. Lioness, what about you? When I say, what's it like being a black woman in the music industry? Is it a similar thought process that comes to mind?
We've kind of been desensitized to, like, this is the way it is, so we just crack on with it. So when I'm hearing everyone's stories, it, like, reminds you, like, it reminded me of stories. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot that happened, because you just get on with it. And it's actually not right that we do that.
I mean, what kind of experiences come to mind? What are the ones that stuck with you?
So for me, it was when an A&R said that I would be better if I were light-skinned. And at the time, I just was like, oh, I don't really, that's not a nice thing to say. I don't really like that. So, and I was 20 years old at the time, and I just thought, oh, I don't like that. If that's what people think, that I would be better if I was light-skinned, I'm not. So, and then I just stopped doing music. I stopped for about 6 years. And it's so mad, because the 30-year-old me would be like, why do you think that? Let's delve into this. Why do you actually think that I would be better if I was light-skinned? So it becomes about, oh, are you more marketable, like, if you're light-skinned? And then why is that? Why is it that if you are lighter-skinned or white, that you are more marketable to the masses? And then these will be the same people that will say that this country isn't racist. We need to speak about racism. And if there's racism, then there's got to be some sort of ignorance. And then if there's ignorance, there's a lack of education. If there's a lack of education, why is that? So you delve deeper and deeper and deeper. And it just shows the wider issue that we all know is there, but we just accept and get on with it.
Mm. So what is an A&R for people that aren't familiar with that term? Who are they and how much power do they have?
Do you know what? Now I would say that an A&R doesn't have much power because we have social media, and it just means that I can go on my phone, do my freestyles, do my songs and curate my own audience and make my own career off the back of that. But back in the day, it was like a door, and you could only get through the door if the A&Rs were there to represent you, bring you into labels and get you seen to get record deals.
So it's like a publicist almost.
Yeah, kind of like that. It's like they scout for you, like a scout, pretty much.
Okay. And this person who said you'd be more marketable if you were light-skinned, was this a white person?
No.
Wow, okay. So that's interesting in itself.
That's the interesting part, exactly. So aside from other races maybe having an issue, you have issues within your own race and that. It just makes it longer. But it's a money thing, so I take it that the A&R believed that he would make more money off of me as an artist if I were light-skinned and I was more marketable to the masses who would then buy into me. But who was it that said that black, dark-skinned females are not marketable or they won't sell? Who said that?
And I can imagine that must have been really difficult because, as you said, you were only 20. Like, you're this young woman and, you know, someone tells you basically that if you were different, you would make it. And it's so sad to hear that. Part of that is what led to you taking a hiatus in music.
Literally, that's what just made me stop. But that's the person I am, or I was, because if I didn't like PE, I wasn't bringing in my kit. I'm just not doing it, guys. Do you know what I mean? So that's how I was. But I will never like look back on that time and be like, oh, I wish that I stayed on or whatever, because I needed to stop doing music to have that break, to understand things, realize my worth completely, so that when I get back into music, I'm not going to stand for it anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you are back making music. You've been making music for the last couple of years. What's changed for you? I mean, the music industry can still be a very difficult culture to be a part of. Do you think you can handle that better now?
Yeah, like I had to do a lot of growing up, a lot of living. I had a lot of things happen to me, traumas and stuff that I had to deal with. And because of all of that living, I've built up my character and I'm much stronger, and I'll be prepared to battle that, because that's not something that I would accept anymore. Like, now I find it challenging. Oh, so you think that you're gonna... Okay, cool. So now it's a game, whereas before it was just like, oh, don't be mean. I don't like that. And just, you know, I mean...
Yeah, you're able to kind of stand up for yourself more now as well.
Yeah, so I don't mind that all of that happened, to be fair. It's done me good.
Jacqueline, you are a music journalist and a music lecturer. You've been a part of this industry for many years and written about this industry for many years. How diverse is it from your perspective?
It's not as diverse as it could be. What we're looking at here, when we think about music... Music is actually about the lived experience, the imagined experience. When you think about Isn't She Lovely, that's a song that Stevie Wonder wrote for his daughter. But based on your own lived experiences, that could be a love song for your partner, whether you are in a same-sex relationship or in a heterosexual relationship. So the way in which you actually go into music, the diversity is man-made. The actual experiences are broadly shared. And so what's so interesting and what is so heartbreaking about so many of the tales that we have heard is that it has everything to do, all of the hurdles have everything to do with the way that we're socialized. The way that men need to be marketed in this way, then girls need to be marketed in this way. Everybody who's ever watched The X Factor has heard Louis Walsh compare black men and black women to people they don't even look like. As if there's this ongoing running joke that, oh yeah, Jaheim, you look like Lenny Henry. No, he doesn't. And do you actually think that at prime time, that kind of sly condescension, it's weaponizing those constructions? And so, sorry, long story short, the whole idea of what diversity is relies upon what is, quote, the norm that diversity has to break. These are all man-made constructions that we all are complicit in upholding. When Lioness just mentioned there that the person that told her that she'd be more marketable if she were light-skinned, ridiculous. And it infects the way that people treat other people within the black within Black society. I'm not saying community because it makes it sound like there's 15 of us or something like that. And it also creates a great deal of pressure on artists to be everything to everybody. They're supposed to be everything to all people because of the imbalance of representation. And the imbalance of representation has everything to do with the way in which people have been constructed to mean more or less than others. So men mean more than women. Certain other women mean less than others. It goes to race, it goes to size, it goes to regionality, it goes to age. That's why you have the overs, that's why you have everything. All of these categories, when you put on a record, categories don't actually exist. Sound doesn't, sound wafts around all of these categories. We have made everything, and I say we, I'm talking about the human race, we've made everything complicated. It's crazy. And music sounds so beautiful, so different, and it keeps on existing. If there was no record industry, music would still be made. And that's fundamentally what we have to remember. People are innately talented. This is just about the sale of music. The making of music exists because humans exist.
Fleur, I know that your experience of being a Black woman in the music industry, part of it has been defined by your hair and the politics of Black hair. So could you tell me a bit about, you know, your experience and what it's been like for you?
I mean, it's just outrageous. I remember my earliest experience was when I was in a group and it was me and another Black girl that also had big, like, Afro hair. And the management team said, Fleur, you're going to have to straighten yours because we can't have two Black girls with big hair. So, you know, there's only got to be one, you know, one's enough. Like, so, you know, you've got to straighten yours. And I was like, huh? I was like, why do I have to straighten? Why can't we both have our big hair? And why can't we both celebrate our big hair? This doesn't make sense. And then I remember it was comments like when I later was on my own. Yeah, I mean, to straighten it will be, you know, sleeker, more appealing to the market, more marketable. You know, your hair's a bit distracting, you know, a bit unruly. And they go, all this. And I was like, hair? I was like, what do you mean? I was like, this is how it grows out of my head. And I remember I went onto TV and I spoke about that. And later that video circulated and the comments that some people were saying, they were like, yeah, so what? Loads of artists get told to change things in the industry. Some get told to lose weight. Some get told to change their style. Some get told to change the way they wear their makeup. That's just like, that's not racist. And I was like, okay, we need to clarify this. So someone suggesting that I straighten my hair, of course, is not racist on its own. It's the motive behind it. Why are you asking me to straighten my hair? You're telling me categorically that my natural Afro hair type will not appeal to the market. That's what you're telling me. You're telling me the market in this society is going to look at my Afro hair and go, that's not appealing to me. Don't want to buy what she's selling. So you need to question the motive behind it. It's not what they're asking me to do. It's why they're asking me to do it.
So when you're told to change your hair, to change your appearance, if there was more honesty about the intentions behind those statements, if you were told, you know, to be completely honest with you, we think you would sell better if you looked like this. We think that a white audience would like you better if you look like this. Would that help? Would that honesty make a difference?
Do you know what though? I think it's interesting because Lioness touched on this. It's not even just white people. It's people in the Black community that will tell you you got to straighten your hair. It's people in the Black community also that will tell you you got to wear a weave or whatever. But I think that's conditioning. It's conditioning, isn't it? And it's also people are afraid to hurt their paper. They're afraid to hurt their bag. Like, they don't want to take that risk and step out and go, no, do you know what? I'm just going to break this mold. It's almost like there's a sense of having to conform. But like it's sad. It's sad. Like, why? Why is a Black person coming to Lioness and saying, babe, you know, you'd be more marketable if you were light skin, you know? Like, how? What? Where did that even come from? That's like a hate to yourself. You're hating yourself. There's a lot of that as well. Like, there's so much confusion. Like, it's just, it's mad. There's when you talk about racism, there's layers upon layers upon layers. There's racism within racism. Like Lioness has touched on, there's a light skin, dark skin debate, which is a whole thing on its own. Like there's so many issues. But I think at the core of it all, the minute that we realise what unites us is more important than what separates us, like as a whole,
that's when we'll stop putting all these labels and putting us into categories all the time. So there's so many issues within the one issue of race. So it's like, it's a bigger conversation, to be fair.
So many of the experiences that we're hearing about, nothing's changing because the people who did them and the infrastructure that upholds the people that employ them have not come out. So even within all of this, even with Misha B, Alexandra Burke telling their truths, there's a chasm of silence. When you have women who write their own material, who come out and tell you, this is what it's like to live like this, it's intimidating in a way where if you don't do certain things, if you aren't kind of one of the boys, there's this ever-present threat of condemnation.
Mm. I mean, Lioness, you, as well as being a black woman in the music industry, you're a grime artist, which is a hugely male-dominated field. I mean, what's that been like?
The men in the scene, they expect you to not be good because you're just a girl. You know, you're just a girl. You know, I mean, back in the day, we used to go on pirate radio and we used to get on the mic and they just wouldn't give me the mic as a girl that's there. And I'm having to get through the crowd and grab the mic to show my worth. Yeah, I find it fun, though, because they expect me to be rubbish. So when I come through and I'm giving them something, they're like, what's this? I like that. And I like I like the fact that sometimes people expect me to be a singer. So I like when I go to places and I'm actually rapping. What? You know, I like that. But in terms of like everything that's been spoken about, it's just been really interesting to see the way in which it's been spoken about. People's experiences are getting pushed to the side or just not being taken seriously. And it's very telling, very telling.
And you have these T-shirts which are sold as part of your marketing brand, which read Angry Black Female. Can you just tell me a bit more about what's the meaning behind that?
So I made a tune called DBT, which stands for Dead Black Ting. And it was to talking about how black men view black women. Yeah. And, you know, part of that song, I was speaking about how black women are just automatically angry. So it's so mad that what we've been talking about, a lot of black women won't speak about it because they're going to be perceived as being angry, bitter. It's just going to, their point of view is going to be cast to the side because, oh, they're just moaning again. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the time people don't say that. And my aesthetic alone, without me saying one word, sends so many signals to people and it tells them the person that I am, and I've said not one word, yeah? And it's typically that I'm angry. So I thought, well, you think that anyway, so why don't I just put it on a T-shirt? So I put Angry Black Female on my T-shirt as part of the campaign with DBT.
So it's almost like, you're going to call me this thing, I might as well take ownership of it.
Exactly. If I want to say, you think I'm going to be an angry black female, I'm going to own it, that's my choice. And that's just what I've done.
I just want to explore something which Jacqueline touched on earlier, which is about the idea that music on its own is diverse and beautiful and doesn't care about labels. It's the music industry itself which can be quite toxic. So Fleur and Lioness, I'm curious to know, as artists, do you feel like products, like commodities, rather than people, rather than individuals? And maybe that's why it can be difficult to speak out about how you're being treated.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what you are. Like, I was never, you know, I was never delusional or ignorant to that. I've always known that. I've never thought otherwise. But that's what's always fascinated me about the music industry. And I remember even seeing an interview with Kanye West and he said something like, artists shouldn't have managers. They should have CEOs. Like, because really and truly, we're a company. Like, we're a business. We're being sold. We're being marketed. And that becomes even more real when you're signed to a massive label and you have a huge machine behind you. It's like every single element is considered because it's like, how's this going to appeal? How's the consumer going to you know, accept this? How's the consumer going to buy into this? Everything, like from the cover of your single, from, you know, the imagery, from everything. And it's like, now being independent, I can definitely see the difference when you have like a huge machine behind you when you're doing it on your own. And like I was beating my head against the wall, and it was demoralizing and it was draining. So the minute you go into the industry and you realize that you are a product, you are a commodity, it's all about selling you. I mean, it does hurt. It starts to suck the love out of it. It does. It's really, really difficult to exist, to be an artist, create, and not be tarnished or bruised by the marketing side of the industry. It's difficult.
There's that saying that people don't buy products, people buy people. So once people go off the back of that statement, everything about that person has to make money. So that's why the way in which you look has to be a certain way for you to get the money that I need from you. Do you know what I mean? That's why, like, the statements that the person said about my complexion, I can't do anything about that. So that's why I just stopped. So it's like, when I came back to music, I was like, I know that I need to be a product, but really, I don't want to take that on board, because then that just governs the type of music I make, the type of person that I am. I have to be true to myself. Otherwise, doing music makes no sense. The reason why I do music is because I love it. It's therapy for me. It's just everything about music. I just love it. So I need to continue with that and focus on that. The minute I try to make it a business, which I understand that it is because the industry has made it that way, the minute I do that, I'm compromised as an artist because I'm thinking all these other things and I can't just create the way I want to create because I'm taking in all these extra added factors that I don't need to. And then it's just a complete waste of time. So I've just decided, look, I'm doing what I want to do. And if you roll with me, I love that. If you don't want to roll with me, there's other artists in the world.
What we're looking at here is also the way in which within that infrastructure of selling sound, women and women of colour, black women, non-white women broadly, come off worse from the experience because of the way in which racism functions, the way sexism functions. Things have got to change because people are damaged. They're emotionally and psychologically damaged by this maltreatment. All of this revelation isn't to avenge people. It's to expunge the weight of this evil.
I just want to finish by asking about the Black Lives Matter movement, which is where this whole discussion started. Do you think that this is a lasting conversation? Do you think what we're talking about today and right now will still have an impact and still feel relevant later down the line?
For as long as we make it last, it will last. So we can't just go back into just getting on with it. If there's something that's unjust that happens, we need to call it out immediately, I think. I think we need to stop shying away from being the complainer, being the, just like what Jacqueline was saying, we are going to be the complainants. People are going to expect that from us, and that's fine, because we have to continue to talk about things that are unjust, or they're going to just continue to happen.
What I've gathered and what I've taken from all of these conversations as well is that I feel like there's like a sense of a lot of people feeling defensive. Like the minute you post something about Black Lives Matter, people are like, yeah, but, you know, this is ridiculous. No, like, you know, I didn't. And it's like, hold on, whoa, who was talking to you? Like, this isn't a personal individual attack. It's all of us against the system. That's what it is. It's like, it's us against the system. Just because it's Black Lives Matter, it doesn't mean, oh, because you're a white person, it's an attack against you as an individual. It's not about that. But there's this sense of defensiveness. And I think that comes from a sense of guilt, if I'm honest, because a lot of like, because obviously I'm of dual heritage. So my dad was white, my mom's black, and I have a lot of white family, obviously. And there's like conversations where people are saying, you know, I'm embarrassed. I'm the more I'm learning, the more I'm embarrassed, the more I'm ashamed, the more I feel guilty that I've been complicit in a lot of situations, or I haven't spoken out against it, or I've actually seen it, or I've laughed at that joke, or I was in that conversation, or I've said those things. And it's that the realization of it, to actually own that and take responsibility for that, takes a lot. And I feel that the opposite of that is being defensive. Like, I've had to have uncomfortable conversations in places that I've worked, with teams that I work with. And it's like, you do, even now, I still feel like, it's gone a bit quiet now. I'm going to have to bring it up again. And it's almost like, again, that dread of having to start the conversation again. And it's like, but do you know what? So what? The ball's rolling. We need to keep it rolling. That's what we need to do.
The music industry is merely an extension of society. Black Lives Matter is a global concern. It concerns wherever black people exist, because black lives matter as well.
Jacqueline Springer, Fleur East and Lioness were speaking to Olivia Cope. Now, lots of you got in touch to talk about your own experience with premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Jo sent an email and said, I've had PMDD my whole life, I now realise. I lost untold friends and boyfriends, was on Prozac and antidepressants. It was only when I was off work sick 15 years or so ago and I heard a Radio 4 programme. I think it was about PMS or PMDD. I joined the Help Association they suggested, got the doctor list, took it to my GP. I was lucky enough to be referred to Dr. Nick Panay, who was the NHS doctor on the radio show, and he changed my life. I've been on the continuous pill ever since, which stops me ovulating. The only dodgy time was when I wanted to get pregnant, but luckily that happened quickly. And I prepared my husband about the PMDD. I don't think he appreciated quite how bad it could get. Marg sent an email. She said, switched on partway through and thought I recognised it. From when I was 12 until I was 35, I think that's what I had. But I thought it was depression, so I had a huge amount of treatment for depression, none of which worked, including a year as a day patient in a psychiatric hospital. A doctor who was treating my child once asked me how I was, and he prescribed multivitamins, zinc and evening primrose oil, because he could see I was pretty down. 2 months later, I was a different person. I'd never noticed until then that the 1 week each month when I could cope, even do things, was the week before my period, and that after that, the next couple of weeks until my period started were a time when I went from average to suicidal. Then I had a very heavy period, which in itself is draining. Then I'd get gradually better, and that first week would kick in. I'm 73 now, and I've never stopped taking the supplements because the memory of the misery of all those years of depression have never left me. Well, thank you for your contributions. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from the ultra-runner Beth Pascal, who's just completed one of the most gruelling Lake District fell runs, very, very fast. How did she go from her first cross-country run at the age of 6 to a speciality distance of 100 miles? And how does she balance being a paediatrician with a very demanding training programme? That's tomorrow. Do join me if you can. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Joe Wicks, and I'm just popping up to tell you about my brand new podcast with BBC Radio 4.
It's extraordinary. It almost turbocharges you.
I'm really interested in the links between physical and mental health and what kind of ordinary, everyday activities people do to keep on top of things.
I keep fit because it's relaxing, because it absolutely relaxes my mind. And that's so important.
So in this podcast, I'm having a chat with some of my favourite people to find out their tips and tricks to staying healthy and happy.
For me, it's a full body experience and it's a total game changer.
I think you're going to love it. Hit subscribe on the Joe Wicks podcast on BBC Sounds.
Let's do this.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.